Okay. Now, I want to pick up today and talk about induction and repression. Because last time we talked about operons, but we focused it almost entirely on induction. And today I want to talk about repression. Now, you don't need the handout from last time for this. I'll draw all the critical parts. Suppose we have an operon, either kind, either inducible or repressible. What do they have in common? The critical feature is that you have an allosteric protein that has two forms. And on your handouts, I've symbolized them this way to imply that the rectangle, so to speak, is sticky. It sticks to the DNA of the respective operon, and the circle form does not. Now, of course, I have to remind you that every operon has its own unique repressor protein. But for any given operon, that protein has two forms. Now, there's certain features of operons that I wanted to stress. If you have the notes, they're listed under general regulation a little bit further on, that you notice that you have this, what is the function of this protein? This protein is needed to turn off synthesis of the appropriate enzymes. It's needed to turn off transcription. So this is called negative control because the regulatory protein is involved in turning things off, not in turning things on. And the step that's controlled is transcription. Now, another feature here is what is this protein going to do? How is it going to turn off transcription? It's going to do that by binding to a site on the DNA, which we've called an operator. Now, this idea that you regulate transcription by having a protein bind to the DNA, you have a two-part switch, special DNA sequence, special protein that binds to it. That is another feature here. And one more feature is that we know that when we turn on or off protein synthesis, we will turn on and off the synthesis of not one protein, but a bunch together. So this is an example of coordinate control. Now, all of these features are characteristic of operons, whether they're inducible or repressible. And these features are very common in all regulatory systems. They're not the only ways to regulate things, but they're all very common. And that's one of the reasons that we've stressed this. Another reason for talking about operons at such length is that the operon system was the first one to be figured out, where a regulatory protein was used to turn on and off the synthesis of other proteins. And so all of our regulatory schemes are really based on this scheme. Everybody has this scheme in mind when they develop a new scheme of regulation. And so people always refer back to this one. So because many of these features are common, and because this is a sort of fundamental discovery, that's why we've stressed operons, even though there are other methods of regulation, as we will discuss as we go through this semester, and especially next semester when we get to eukaryotes. So, with that in mind, then, all these features are general to both inducible and repressible operons. So, what's the big difference? You could say the big difference is the role of the effector. Now, what do we mean by the effector? We mean the small molecule that's either an inducer or a co-repressor. Now, in the case of induction, this inducer is needed to turn synthesis on. In the case of co-repression, this effector is needed to turn synthesis off. So the big difference is whether the small molecule shifts this equilibrium to the right or to the left. If the effector shifts it to the right, what's going to happen? If we shift it to the right, all our repressor does not bind to the DNA, and the operon will be on. So in the case of induction, the inducer shifts it to the right. But in the case, what if all of our repressor protein is in the rectangle form, that it sticks to the respective operator, turns the operon off? So, in the case of repression, the co-repressor shifts the equilibrium to the left and turns the operon off. So, last time, the way we wrote it, is we said in the case of induction, you had a repressor protein, and you had the inducer. And when the inducer binds, it either shifts the shape of the allosteric protein or stabilizes it. So clearly, when you have a lot of inducer, this whole equilibrium goes to the right. We turn the operon on. Now, what's the situation with repression? It's exactly reversed. So one way to write repression is this way. So the little circle is the inducer. The little triangle is the co-repressor. Notice that each repressor is different. It has a specific binding site for its partner, either inducer or co-repressor. Now, is there anything else different about these two? If this one is, say, the repressor of the trip operon, and the one on the top is the repressor of the lac operon, these two are different in that one binds lactose, one binds tryptophan. But they have another difference. They bind only to their respective operators. So the part that sticks to the DNA is also different. So maybe we should draw something like this up here, and because they bind to different DNA sequences. Now, there's only one other way of writing this that's perhaps useful. The way we've written it so far, if you compare these two, you can see that the effector either drives the equilibrium one way or the other way, toward rectangle, toward circle. But you can also consider it in terms of when the repressor protein is made, what is it like? When it's made, it's empty. So in the case of induction, the empty form is ready to sit on the operator and turn things off. But in the case of a repressible system, you have to have co-repressor. So let's turn B around, and you get this. All I've done is turn the reaction around. If you compare A and B, you compare the effect of the effector. If you compare A and C, though, what you're really comparing is when the protein is made, what state is it in? Are things on or are things off? When the protein is empty here, which is the operon, on or off? Does this sit on the operator? If it sits on the operator, what will happen to the operon? It'll be off. But if we have the circle form, then will it sit on the operator? No. So in the absence of any effector, the operon is going to be?
On.
It's going to be on, not off. Okay. So I'm going to leave it at this. But the point is that depending on what feature you're trying to consider, you might want to compare A with B or A with C. But both of these systems share all the features that we mentioned earlier. Now, I want to switch gears and talk about bacterial sex. So let me ask first if there are any questions about this so far.
Well, you wrote down a two-part switch. I didn't catch that.
What did I mean by a two-part switch? I meant that in order to turn the operon off, you have a special DNA sequence and a protein that sits on it. And the two halves have to pair up. That's the repressor protein and the operator.
So for the operon?
The whole operon, the production of polycistronic message from the operon, has a two-part switch. And the idea of a switch on the DNA, a special sequence that a protein has to bind to, and that either ups or downs transcription, that turns out to be very common. Okay. So when I say bacterial sex, we don't think of bacteria as having sex. That biologically speaking, what sex means is some way of reshuffling the genetic material. Now, that's what biologists mean. Now, most of us as human beings mean something else. When we talk about human sex, we're usually talking about the behaviors that lead up to the opportunity to reshuffle the genetic material. But today I want to talk about how bacteria do it. How do they reshuffle their genetic material? And the answer is that there are actually three methods, which I have written here. There is transformation, conjugation, and transduction. Now, we've already talked about transformation. What's critical here is that the DNA from one source is released or isolated and added to another bacterium. So the recipient picks up some DNA. In conjugation, so this is a DNA transfer. And just for the record, this is sometimes called transfection in higher organisms. Conjugation, on the other hand, is a kind of mating. And that it requires contact between two cells, and then some DNA can be transferred from the donor to the recipient. Transduction also involves some transfer of DNA from a donor to recipient, but the agent of transfer here is a virus. A virus infects one host and accidentally picks up some DNA and carries it to the next host. Now, what all three of these have in common is that a little bit of DNA from one source is transferred to another cell. When we think of the reshuffling of genetic information, I think we mentioned this last time, a whole set comes from your mother, a whole set comes from your father, and the progeny have two whole sets. Here it's a little bit different. The donor provides a little bit, and the recipient, of course, has its own complete set, and it gets a little bit extra. So that if we consider a bacterium with its chromosome, and now at this point, maybe you want to look at the bottom of 16B for today. That's the chromosome, but since it's so big in the picture, it's been written all tangled up. This is the recipient, and it gets a little bit extra. So what is that little bit extra? It's either a fragment or it's a plasmid. Now, notice that this cell does not have two complete copies of everything. This cell has one complete copy of its genome plus a little something additional. Now, I've drawn single lines here, but the chromosome is double-stranded DNA, and what is added usually is also. So all these lines represent double-stranded DNA, or the equivalent. Now, we mentioned last time what the difference here. A plasmid is a small circular sort of mini chromosome. And the critical thing is that it has an origin of replication. So that means that when the DNA of the chromosome is copied or replicated, the DNA of the plasmid will be also. And so that both will be copied and the descendants will get both. So if you look at your picture, it says plasmid versus fragment, but plasmid is on the right. If this gives rise to descendants, and you can get first two, and then four, and then eight, every one of these descendants will have a copy of the plasmid. So whatever extra information was in the plasmid, all of the offspring will get it. Now notice it's different with a fragment. A fragment generally has no origin of replication. So in fact, usually, it isn't replicated, and often it is simply degraded and lost. But if it's not degraded, if this offspring divides into two and then four, only one of them will get the one and only copy of the plasmid. Excuse me, of the fragment. So this little bit of extra DNA will be in one of the offspring, but not the others. Now, therefore, you might ask, what good is a fragment? And the answer is temporarily it provides extra information, but in some cases the fragment can add onto or replace part of the basic chromosomal DNA. So if the fragment gets integrated, it isn't lost. And we'll explain how that happens in a little bit. But you notice that in both of these cases, the cell only has a little bit extra. That little bit extra can be a second copy of something that's already there. Alternatively, this little bit extra can be a totally new piece of DNA from a different kind of organism, or either naturally or by genetic engineering. Now, I want to look a little more closely, first at what happens to plasmids, and then what happens to fragments. Now, in the simplest case, both what's on the chromosome and what's on the plasmid are replicated and passed on. We've already talked about a case of this, which is important. I drew the plasmid in two colors because one possibility is that this little bit, what I've drawn in orange, is sort of added. If this little orange part is a copy of a piece of the bacterial chromosome, then this cell has two copies of that particular part. And that's what we mean by a partial diploid. The cell is haploid, or has only one copy of most of its genetic information, but for one section it's diploid. And this allows you to do those kinds of experiments that are in your problem set, where you have two copies of an operon with different properties, and you ask, what happens? Now, as we will see later, many plasmids can be passed around, copies of them can be passed around from cell to cell. And one of the questions that arises is, why doesn't every bacterium loaded with plasmids? How is it that everybody doesn't have every possible plasmid? And one of the answers is that plasmids over many, many generations tend to get lost from the population. Now, it's not clear whether control of distribution of plasmids is not as good, or whether it's just a survival question. But a cell that doesn't replicate its chromosome properly, and the daughter cell gets only the plasmid, what will happen to this daughter cell? No chromosome. Kaput. Because it doesn't have most of the genes, can't make most of the proteins, it won't function. But what about a cell that just gets a copy of the chromosome, but no plasmid? It depends on what genes are on the plasmid. It's quite likely that the plasmid genes are extra and of no significance, and this cell will survive just fine. So we know that cells that don't get chromosomes die out, and we never know about them. Cells that don't get plasmids, though, sometimes survive. So, over time, just by accident, cells arise that have no plasmid. Now, if you start out with a culture where every cell has a plasmid, what will happen over many, many generations? And this depends on the selection. Is there an advantage to carrying the plasmid or not? For example, the plasmid may carry the genes for antibiotic resistance. It turns out that many genes that cause drug resistance and give us grief are carried not on the chromosomes of bacteria, but on their plasmids, for reasons that we will explain. Now, we know that some cells will lose the plasmid just by accident, and others will not. The presence or absence of drug has no effect on this loss. It doesn't increase the probability of loss or maintain. But once this mistake happens, The presence of the drug determines who will flourish and leave descendants and who will not. If the drug is present, does either of these have an advantage? So if we have drug, then the cells with the plasmid are resistant and will flourish and will leave offspring. And the cells that don't have the plasmid will die off from the drug and will not leave offspring. So under these conditions, the drug-resistant one will out-reproduce the drug-sensitive one, and the population will all be maintained as drug-resistant. But what if there is no drug? Does number two have an advantage? Not anymore. So one possibility is that both types of bacteria have equal numbers of offspring and leave equal numbers of descendants. But another possibility is the bacterium with a plasmid may even have a disadvantage because it's carrying a plasmid and bothering to reproduce DNA it doesn't need at all. So either they'll both give descendants, in which case we say both are quote unquote equally fit, or it is possible that, in fact, the one without the plasmid will outbreed the other. And so, if there is no selection at all for either type, if they are equally fit, then over time, an occasional bacterium will lose its plasmid and leave descendants. And over time, eventually, everything will have lost its plasmid. So without selection for keeping the plasmid, eventually, just by accidental loss, the population will lose its plasmids. Now, one of the points of bringing this up, there are several. First of all, the presence of drug or the selective conditions don't affect the incidence of loss, but they affect the incidence of reproduction once loss has occurred. Second of all, what is most fit depends on the environment. In the presence of drug, clearly number two is most fit. In the absence of drug, it's not so clear. Now, this example that I've just used is not only academic. By the extensive use of drugs, of antibiotics, in hospitals, in outpatients with animals who produce food, by spreading the drugs around, we have in fact accidentally selected very strongly for bacteria that are drug resistant. So that over time, bacteria become more in a larger and larger proportion of the population of bacteria becomes drug resistant, and we have to keep inventing new drugs. This is a kind of arms race. You can never stop, and at the moment who knows who's ahead? It depends who you ask. But it takes constant vigilance to keep ahead. Now, we see what happens to plasmids. If the plasmid confers an advantage, then the plasmid will be passed on efficiently generation after generation after generation. Even without an advantage, it will be passed on pretty well, but eventually it'll get lost. What happens to a fragment? Well, we said already that enzymes can degrade this, and it usually gets lost. But there is another possibility. Whenever you have two equivalent copies, which I'll draw this way, there is a possibility for recombination. So these are two double-stranded DNA molecules. These are not Watson and Crick. These are both double-stranded. But recombination can occur if the two DNAs are homologous and if you have the right enzymes. We'll explain homologous a little bit better in a minute. Now, what do I mean by recombination, which is also called crossing over? What can happen is the appropriate enzyme can cut the two DNAs at equivalent spots. And now other enzymes can rejoin the DNAs. Now, the interesting question is, if they get put back right the way they were before, it's of no great interest. But if you join the end of the top to the end of the bottom, top left to bottom right, and bottom left to top right, then you end up with two new combinations. And now if I unentangle them, each of my new DNAs is what is called recombinant. It has a piece of the original white and a piece of the original orange. Now, in order for this to work, you have to have the right enzymes, of course. But why do I say the DNAs have to be homologous? Now, you don't want to go around scrambling your DNA. You have to switch equivalent parts for equivalent parts, or you're going to get chaos. So remember, we've talked about the genes for tryptophan synthetase and the genes for, say, beta-galactosidase. So suppose they were here. So let's add those. Suppose this is the gene for tryptophan synthetase, and here is the location of the gene for beta-galactosidase. Now, as long as I switch a region with the beta-galactosidase for another region with beta-galactosidase, I'm okay. What won't do is if I scramble it. Now, the way I've drawn it, the two DNAs look the same, except for color. But what do I mean by homologous? Homologous means they have the same genes in the same order at about the same positions. But they don't necessarily have the same versions of the same genes. It is possible, for example, that the beta-galactosidase gene on the white chromosome could have a few base changes. That means that the respective protein will be slightly different than the protein coded for by the version of the beta-galactosidase gene on the other chromosome. These two versions of the beta-galactosidase gene are called alleles. Now, they don't code for different proteins. They code for different versions of the same protein. So if this, say, is beta-galactosidase made by the orange version of the gene, the white version of the gene has a few different changes in the bases, has a few different changes in the amino acids, but basically the protein is the same. It's another version of beta-galactosidase. It may have a slightly different Vmax, slightly different Km, slightly different temperature sensitivity, but it's going to catalyze the same reaction and do about the same thing. Now, we have already dealt with one example of alleles and homology, although those terms weren't used. Earlier in the semester, Dr. Chazen talked about hemoglobin S and hemoglobin A. This is normal hemoglobin and sickle cell hemoglobin. Now, bacteria don't make hemoglobin, but humans do. And there are this difference is caused by differences in the beta chain of hemoglobin. The gene for the beta chain of hemoglobin has at least two different alleles or versions. They're what people call the beta S allele and the beta A allele. These two differ in a single amino acid, a single nucleotide is different in the DNA, a single base pair. As a result, so the two DNAs are very, very similar. They're homologous. They code for different versions of the beta chain. They're only different by one nucleotide pair, but the corresponding protein is different by one amino acid. So beta A codes for a beta chain that has glutamic in position 6, and beta S codes for a beta chain that has valine in position 6. Both of these carry oxygen, but one polymerizes and one doesn't, so one causes sickle cell disease and one does not. So the point here is that these are two different alleles of the same gene, and they code for two different versions of the same protein, not different proteins. So in order to have crossing over, obviously, you have to have homology, and you have to have the enzymes. Now, in higher organisms, you have homology all the time. All of your cells, virtually, have two copies of the genetic information. So you have two homologous copies of every gene. So why doesn't crossing over occur in your cells all the time? Because it doesn't. Recombination in humans is limited to cells that are forming gametes and carrying out meiosis. Most of your cells, your body cells, don't do it at all. And the reason is, in humans and in higher organisms, what is limiting is the enzymes. Humans are diploid all the time, but most cells don't have the enzymes to carry out this process. In bacteria, it seems to be the other way around. Bacteria have the enzymes to carry this process out all the time. But normally, bacteria are haploid and have only one copy of the DNA. But if a second copy of the DNA is introduced so that the cell has a partial diploidy, then those enzymes can cut and splice the DNA. Now let's see how this works out in actual cases of transformation, conjugation, and transduction. We've explained that if a cell gets a little bit of extra DNA, what could happen to that extra DNA? It could just be passed on from generation to generation if it's on a plasmid, and it could be crossed over or recombined if it's a fragment. But now let's look at the three methods of transfer and see how they lead to this state. Now, we'll do them in order. We already talked about transformation when we talked about converting PS minus to BS plus. In fact, transformation was the first of these to be discovered and the first indication that DNA, the first really strong indication that DNA was the genetic material. Now, what's the basic process? The basic process is that DNA could be released by a dying bacterium, or it could be manipulated in a laboratory. One way or the other, the DNA is broken into relatively small pieces. So there is a test tube or medium which has pieces of DNA in it. And this DNA is then taken up by the recipient bacteria. Some bacteria do this naturally. Almost all of them can be convinced to do this in the lab by the proper manipulations. And what is the result of all this? Can I get a volunteer to pull this down for me? Thank you. So the result of this transfer is now the situation you have on the bottom of 16A. Thank you very much. So let's look at the bottom of 16A. So what we're saying here is you have a bacterium that has its own complete chromosome, and a fragment has been added, either naturally taken up by the bacteria or by genetic manipulation in a laboratory. Now, we've put marks on these chromosomes, these pieces of DNA, to make it clear that they are homologous. So gene A, with alleles, little a, big A, is over here. And gene B, with alleles, little b, big B. And gene D, with alleles, big D, little d. Now, there are other genes, of course, on this chromosome. We don't have a second allele of those genes. There's no homology there. So this is a partial diploid, temporarily. It has a little fragment that overlaps what it already had. Now, this can happen as a result of transformation. And now you can get crossing over or recombination. And the interesting part, these are double-stranded DNAs. What happens if we cut and rejoin the DNA twice? In my demonstration here, I only did it once. But here, suppose we want to switch allele big B for allele little b. What this is going to require is two cut and rejoin events. We're going to have one cut and rejoin event, which is one symbolizes a little X here, meaning all of these steps, and another cut and rejoin event between A and B. Now that means that we've joined the little a on the chromosome to the big B on the fragment, to the little d on the chromosome. So, as shown in your next picture, the third picture, if I unentangle everything, it now looks like this. Now, remember we said that when you have a fragment, it usually gets degraded. If no crossing over occurs, the added fragment is degraded, it's lost, its information is lost, goodbye. But now that we've done this crossing over event, and now we degrade the fragment, what we're going to get left with is something different than the original. It's going to have little d, big B, little a. And all of its descendants will also carry big B. Now, how are we going to detect this? Consider the case that we did before, where we said this came from a cell, the fragment that was PS plus, and the original chromosome was PS minus. That means that big B allowed you to make some enzyme that allows you to synthesize polysaccharide, and little b gave you inactive enzyme. So the original cell had only little b, couldn't make active enzyme, couldn't make polysaccharide. But now, what about our cell at the end? This cell has big B, makes active enzyme, and will make polysaccharide. And how will we detect that this cell is PS plus? We have to have a selection scheme again. We have to have something where PS plus looks different or grows and PS minus does not. Now, the mouse, unfortunately for the mouse, is a very good selection system. The PS plus flourishes inside the mouse and kills the mouse. The PS minus does not. These can also be told apart. The original PS minus makes rough colonies. The new PS plus will make smooth ones. So in order to detect that big B has replaced little b, we have to have some change in phenotype that we can detect. The change I drew up here is genotype, change in the DNA. We have to have a phenotypic or property change in order to detect it. Now, transformation here is shown as involving a fragment. Transformation in nature involves fragments. Transformation in the laboratory can involve plasmids. People make plasmids in the laboratory containing whatever extra sequences they like, and then using transformation, they introduce these plasmids into recipient cells. This is the basis of a great deal of genetic engineering, and it's the way in which additional genes are added. But now I want to go back and look at conjugation. We see how transformation works. Pieces of DNA are released or manipulated in the lab and then taken up by cells. Now, we said conjugation is a little different. Conjugation is a kind of mating. It actually requires contact between the donor cell and the recipient cell. Those of you who are taking the laboratory are doing a conjugation experiment. Conjugation was very important in the early days of figuring out the genetics of bacteria. It's not done as much anymore. But it's a very interesting phenomenon. In conjugation, you have a circular DNA, either a plasmid or a chromosome, and it is copied starting from one point, but so as to have a free end. So copying is going this way. Now, it's going to be a copy that is transferred to the recipient. You don't give away your one and only chromosome. You don't even give away your one and only copy of the plasmid. What you do is make a copy and transfer the copy. And this cell will then mate with a cell that has no such copy. And this copy will be transferred over the bridge to the recipient. Now, the cell that does the donation is called an F plus or an HFR. We'll explain the difference. And the cell that is recipient is an F minus. The genes that allow this connection, the building of the bridge, the copying of the DNA, and the transferring, the genes that allow this mating were originally discovered on a plasmid and are normally found on a plasmid. So that plasmid is called the fertility factor. At least that's what they claim it stands for. But when you think of things being F plus and F minus, it's possible it stands for something else. Think about it. Something I can't say on TV. So you have here this fertility factor, so that cells that were originally discovered had their regular chromosome, and then they had their little plasmid that contained the fertility factor. And so this cell is said to be F plus, because it has the fertility factor. And such a cell has the genes to make the bridge, copy the plasmid, and send a copy of the plasmid across to the recipient. Now, because of this, if there are genes on the plasmid, when the plasmid is copied, whatever genes are on this plasmid will be copied and sent as well. So if this plasmid carries the genes for drug resistance, this plasmid will be copied, and the genes for drug resistance will be easily passed from one cell to another. You could almost say that drug resistance is contagious. Now, the recipient for this to work has to lack an F factor, because the surfaces of these two cells have to be complementary. One has to be F minus, one has to be F plus. Now, what's this HFR business? This is meant to be the bacterial chromosome. This is meant to be the plasmid. These are not to scale. The plasmid would be much bigger. People have discovered that in some cases, you can get a crossing over or a recombination event between the DNA of the chromosome and the DNA of the plasmid. That there is a region between them, a region of homology, which allows them to pair up. So we pair up and we do one of those cut and rejoin jobs. Now, what happens if you do a cut and rejoin between two circles? Ta-da! Except it fell apart. You end up with a great big circle. And the short plasmid is now part of the whole big shebang. Now, this state of an integrated plasmid is called an integrated F plasmid, is called an HFR for high frequency. Now, what can happen now? If you have the plasmid has some special spot at which copying starts and transfer starts. Well, now that little spot is inside the chromosome. Here is that little spot that says start here. So what happens? If we start here and we copy the chromosome, that little piece will be transferred. But what happens when we get around to here? We'll start transferring copies of the bacterial chromosome, pieces of the bacterial chromosome. And the longer we wait, the more and more parts of the bacterial chromosome will manage to get copied and transferred. As it happens, the bridge tends to break before you can finish the job. It takes too long. So on the average, when you have one of these integrated Fs or an HFR, you send over copies of some of the genes, but not all of them. Now, do you ever send over the entire F? Very, very rarely. Because to send a copy of the entire F, you have to go all the way around the chromosome, all the way back, and get the other half of the F. But what if the F factor is separate? Then you start at the right spot, and you go around, and you make a copy, and you transfer the copy. The F is pretty short, So there's a good chance that the bridge will last long enough to send over an entire copy of the F. So when an F plus mates with an F minus, the recipient usually becomes F plus. F plusness is contagious. But when an HFR, an integrated F cell, mates with an F minus, usually what's transferred is a piece of the F and a piece of the bacterial chromosome. Now, what does it look like if you transfer an F? If you transfer a whole F, you have a recipient with its whole chromosome and a plasmid. And we know what happens. What happens if you transfer a piece of the bacterial chromosome? Then your picture looks exactly the same as our transformation picture. This is the little bit sent, this is the copy that you got from the donor. And you only get a little bit. There's only a little bit. Now, if you look at this, should all parts be transferred equally well? Notice that if you time the mating, you'll send copies of this gene first, this gene later, this gene later. You're more likely to send copies of these genes than a further down, further down, further down. Now, you may remember we said that these plasmids sometimes carry the genes for drug resistance. How does a plasmid get a gene for drug resistance? In fact, we know most of those genes, once upon a time, were bacterial genes. How did they get from the bacterial chromosome onto a plasmid? Now, the answer lies in the reverse of the process that I just did. I did a cut and rejoin job, which put the plasmid in the middle of the chromosome. This process can be reversed, and it can be reversed properly. We pair up the same two spots, cut the DNA, and rejoin it properly. I have to be careful, I'll twist my tubing. And we end up with the two circles we started with. Now that's uninteresting. We haven't really achieved anything, we just gotta get back to the beginning. But sometimes it doesn't work quite right. So I'm going to put my plasmid back in the chromosome. And suppose accidentally they pair up at the wrong spot. So what I've done is to make a loop here, pairing them up at a different spot. Now because of the way I did it, notice that this part of the chromosome, which used to be part of the bacterial chromosome, is now going to end up part of the plasmid. Because when I do my break and rejoin, I didn't do it even Steven. Now, what about this cell? Is this cell going to be okay? Is there anything wrong with this cell? Unless I made the break in the middle of a gene, this cell has all the genes it had before. They're just in a different place. So this cell will probably not have any difference in phenotype. This cell will probably be okay. But now when you make a copy of the plasmid and send it, that copy of the plasmid will include a copy of some bacterial genes. So these bacterial genes now that have become part of the plasmid can be copied and passed on indefinitely. This seems to have happened with the genes for drug resistance and many genes that are of use to the bacterium, but not necessarily to us. Once those genes get on a plasmid, then any cell that gets this plasmid has a big selective advantage, multiplies at the expense of those without the plasmid, and this plasmid becomes more and more widespread. So the big feature of conjugation, then, is that you have to have contact between the donor cell and the recipient cell. The donor cell has to have the genetic information derived or on a fertility factor, which allows it to pair up, make the bridge, copy the DNA, and send the copy over. Now I want to talk about the last example, which is transduction. So let me ask before I do that if there are any questions so far. Yeah?
With HFR, when it's only transferring part of the original plasmid, does the new cell get the plasmid, in the new cell work the way it
If you have one of these integrated plasmids, an HFR, and you send a copy which is half a plasmid and a piece of bacterial DNA, that half a plasmid essentially doesn't function in the recipient because you need the other half of the plasmid to do anything.
So the recipient is still F-?
So the recipient will still be F-. But it will be able to integrate those genes from the previous bacterium that were transferred over. Now, how does a virus accidentally carry bacterial information from one cell to the next? So this is a little like the tourist who goes to a hotel and packs up the towels in his suitcase and carries them to the next hotel. Except that by putting the towels in his suitcase, he doesn't have room and he forgets his own clothes. So how is this? To understand this, we have to actually look at the viral life cycle. So that's diagrammed on 16A. This is, as you may imagine, really an excuse to talk about bacteria, talk about viruses, which we wanted to do anyway. How are viruses different from regular cells? So this is a cycle, which means that we could start discussing it anywhere, but we're going to start at the upper left, where we have a virus attaching to a bacterium. So we have here a schematic virus particle and a schematic bacterium. Now, all viruses have a similar structure, that they have a head made of protein, which usually has a repetitive structure, something like a geodesic dome, where a very small number of pieces are used over and over to construct a hollow shell. And inside, they have nucleic acid. The shell protects the nucleic acid. But notice there's only one kind of nucleic acid in here. All cells have both DNA and RNA. Viruses only have one or the other. Therefore, although they have genetic information, they don't have the information to read it out. They don't have ribosomes. They don't have the whole transcription system, the whole protein synthesizing system. So even their genetic information is just an inert package. It's going to take the cell to read that genetic information and make something of it. They also don't have the enzymes you need for energy metabolism. They can't make their own ATP. If they need energy, they'll have to rob the cell, which is their host. So a virus particle is inert. By itself, it can do nothing. You can crystallize these particles and leave them on a shelf indefinitely. But once the virus particle gets inside a cell, then it will take over the cell, re-engineer the cell, and switch the factory from guns to butter, so to speak, or butter to guns, depending on your analogy. So how does the virus get inside its genetic information inside the cell? That varies from virus to virus, but what is critical is that the virus has to attach to the cell surface. So there must be a match between the surface of the virus and the surface of the cell. Now, we already said that the nucleic acid inside the virus can be, it's only one kind, it can be DNA, RNA, single-stranded, double-stranded. For the sake of this argument, we'll stick to double-stranded DNA. The details are different if it's RNA, single-stranded DNA, etc. The cell, of course, itself has double-stranded DNA chromosome. So you have to have a complementary fit, like between an F plus and an F minus, an enzyme and a substrate. So here we have a model of a virus. So you sort of get the idea. Many bacterial viruses have this basic shape. Not all of them, but many. That is, they have a head structure which contains the nucleic acid and then a kind of tail which attaches to the surface of the cell. And the tail has to match up with the surface of the cell. So if this is a patch of cell surface, this is the tail of the virus. It doesn't stick here, doesn't stick here, but it sticks here. So once you have this complementary fit, that allows ultimately the genetic information of the virus to enter the cell. In some cases, the entire virus particle enters the cell. But in many cases, it is only the nucleic acid. The bacterial viruses that look like this head-tail combination basically inject their DNA. It passes through the tail into the bacteria. So in this picture, that's what we've drawn. We've drawn the viral DNA entering the cell. And leaving the shell behind. The viral nucleic acid itself is sufficient to commandeer the cell and produce a whole new virus. An experiment showing this was another one that convinced people that DNA was the genetic material, because the protein doesn't have to get in. Only the DNA has to get in to cause the cell to make more virus. Did you have a question? Okay. So now, how does this DNA or genetic information take over the host cell? The critical thing is to make messenger RNA, because that messenger RNA can then be read by the ribosomes, transfer RNA, etc. of the cell to make the proteins that will then assist in viral reproduction. So, the original DNA is used to make message, which is then translated to make proteins. And the DNA is itself replicated to make many copies of the genetic information. Now, I've drawn two kinds of protein here to indicate that some of the protein is actually going to end up in the head or shell of the virus. It's structural protein. It's needed to construct new virus. But there are other proteins here as well, which are not going to end up in the virus, but they are enzymes and other proteins which are going to help aid viral reproduction at the expense of cell reproduction. They may aid in DNA replication, specific helping to transcribe the viral DNA instead of the bacterial, help destroy the bacterium, etc., etc., etc. So there are at least two classes of proteins. Now, you may notice that what's going on here is a little different than what generally happens when something grows. When a cell reproduces, how does a cell do it? A cell grows to double the normal size and divides in half. Did our virus do that? It did not. In fact, our virus fell apart. And some of the parts were used as instructions to make up a pile of new parts. We have here a kind of assembly line reproduction. The virus genetic information directs the synthesis of more viral genetic information, more viral structural protein, and now in the next step, we can put it together. So the virus DNA and the viral protein associate to form complete viral particles. Now this is similar to the way in which a ribosome assembles. This isn't just a single protein folding up, but a whole bunch of proteins and their matching nucleic acid all fold up together to form the functional 3D operating system. So this is called self-assembly, like with a ribosome, and can be done in a test tube. And this allows people, by genetic engineering, to make recombinant virus in which the DNA is of one source and the protein shell is from another. Now, what is the final step here? Once you have complete virus, the virus has to be released from the cell. And in many bacteria, this happens by the breaking open of the cell. This happens in many virus, but not all virus life cycles, that you have what is called lysis, or the breaking open of the cell, and the release of particles. Some virus-infected cells shed virus without being lysed. But this is the lytic cycle, in which the overstuffed cell bursts open. either as a result of enzymes which degrade its membrane and wall, or simply by being overstuffed. Now, this is a cycle, of course. So what will happen is these virus particles will infect other cells and make more virus particles, which will infect more cells and make more virus particles. And this is, in fact, because this is a cycle, is the reason it was discovered. A researcher in France left on the surface of his lab bench a bunch of petri dishes that were solidly covered with bacteria. This is called a lawn of bacteria. And when he came back in the morning, he found there were holes in his solid coating of bacteria. And this hole is called a plaque. He said, somebody has been eating my bacteria. He realized that some living or reproducing thing, one of them had landed here. It had eaten the bacteria and reproduced. And its offspring had eaten more bacteria and reproduced and eaten more bacteria. These holes are to viruses what colonies are to bacteria. They are clones. A single virus or bacterial particle has landed and reproduced. If it's a bacterium, it makes a lump. If it's a virus, it makes a hole, assuming there are bacteria to eat. So since he said something has been eating my bacteria, he called them bacteriophage, bacteria eaters, or phage for short. So bacteriophage or phage is the name of a bacterial virus. This doesn't mean virus. It means bacterial virus. Now, bacterial viruses themselves have their own genetics, their own way of reshuffling their genetic material, and their own inheritance. But we brought this up because we wanted to explain how a virus can carry out transduction. So let's go back and look at that, and the virus-specific stuff I'll talk about next time. Let's go back now to this stage of self-assembly. You have a pile of PED protein and a pile of nucleic acid, and they come together. Some viruses produce enzymes that break up the DNA of the host. So one of the enzymes made under the viral instructions cuts up the bacterial DNA. That prevents the bacterial DNA from making its own protein, doing its own thing. But if it does that, notice that in this cell, maybe I should have drawn it back at this stage, in this cell now, there are two piles of pieces of DNA. There are viral pieces of DNA, but there are also bacterial pieces of DNA. And sometimes, just by mistake, one of the virus particles that is formed has virus protein around bacterial DNA. So this little piece of DNA is actually bacterial. Now, what's going to happen if that particular particle hits an uninfected cell? This particle has viral protein on the outside, so it will attach to a cell and inject its DNA. But where did this DNA fragment come from? Came from the previous guy, right? So this is exactly the same picture as the bottom of your handout. A cell that got a fragment from another bacterium, courtesy of the virus. So this is the towel analogy. When the virus packs in the accidental piece of bacterial DNA, there's no room for its own viral DNA. And so what it's carrying around is the bacterial DNA by mistake. And one author calls this a phony phage. I guess with an E. Which I think is a pretty good name for it. So viruses then can accidentally A small percentage of the virus particles then, instead of containing viral DNA, can contain bacterial DNA. And a cell that's infected by one of those phony phages will not be destroyed by the virus, but will in fact be able to integrate the fragment which has been transferred to it. Now, for the remaining moments, I want to consider a possibility of what can happen if you have two copies of the DNA in a cell. We have been considering the possibility that you have a plasmid, and the plasmid just sits there and passes on its copies. Or that you have a fragment, and pieces of the fragment can be integrated by crossing over. I want to take a closer look at that, and I want to talk about the phenomenon called complementation. And to do that, you want to look one more time at your handout for today. You want to look at B, the top of B. Consider here is, again, we want to start with two bacteria. This part's not on your hand now. And we assume each of them has something wrong, a mistake in its DNA. And as a result, each of them has the same phenotype. Let's say trip minus, can't make tryptophan. Now, suppose you carry out an experiment in the laboratory using either transduction, transformation, or conjugation. A little bit from one is transferred to the other. So now the cell is partially diploid, either temporarily or permanently, with a little bit extra. For this discussion, it doesn't matter whether the extra piece for the moment is a fragment or a plasmid. It's on a fragment or a plasmid. Now, how can you get back function? How can you get a cell that will be tryptophan positive and pass that property on from generation to generation? So one possibility is what we've been talking about, recombination. So if you look at your handout now, we have the two copies of the DNA. We have case A and case C. Now again, remember, these are double-stranded DNAs. This is not Watson and Crick. This is two different double-stranded DNAs. One came from the donor, one came from the recipient. And each of them has a mistake so that the corresponding cell couldn't do something. So one possibility is these two errors are in different spots on the DNA, and the other is that they are in the same or overlapping spots of the DNA. Will we ever be able to get a trip plus bacterium out of this? Which case? Notice in A, by cutting and rejoining the DNA appropriately, we could make a good copy of the DNA. By a cut and splice, I shouldn't say splice, a cut and rejoin somewhere around here, we could join the good part of the top chromosome to the good part of the bottom chromosome, and the bacterium that got the good chromosome would be trip plus. It would restore function, and that would be passed on generation after generation. So by crossing over or recombination, we could get function back. Let's suppose there is no crossing over, but you just have two copies. But for some reason, there isn't any crossing over allowed. It isn't. The setup doesn't allow it. Can you get function back just by having two copies? You have to now consider, where are those mutations? Now, if they're both in the same place, you're not going to get anywhere. But suppose we know these two mutations are not in exactly the same place. They are not overlapping. Well, remember, the DNA is divided up into genes, different sections that code for different peptides. So I'm going to divide this up into two genes. One possibility is my mutations are in different genes, and the other one is they're in different places in the same gene. Now, what do I mean by genes? I mean this codes for a peptide that catalyzes some step in the synthesis of tryptophan. It's needed to make tryptophan. But we'll call it peptide A. And this codes for peptide B, which also catalyzes some necessary step in the making of tryptophan. A normal cell makes peptide A, peptide B, and makes tryptophan. But this cell had something wrong with one of them, didn't make tryptophan. This cell had something wrong with one of them, didn't make tryptophan. So now we have cases B and D. Will either of the cells that has both copies be able to make tryptophan? What about the bottom one? Can it make good peptide B? Yeah, no problem. Can it make good peptide A? No. But what about the top one? The top one, the top chromosome makes good peptide B. The bottom chromosome makes good peptide A. And as long as both copies remain, this cell will be okay. Function will be restored. This is called complementation. The two mutations are said to complement each other, meaning that the good part of each one covers the bad part of the other one. And as long as the two remain, you are okay. Now, will every daughter cell get a copy of both? If the picture is the way I drew it, with a fragment and a chromosome, the fragment's not going to be copied. And so although this cell will have function, most of its descendants will not. But suppose the picture was the other situation, where one copy is on a plasmid and one copy is on the chromosome. And now this cell has function. What about the descendants? They will have function too. And it's as long as both copies remain, they will have function. Now, therefore, there are two ways to get back function. One is by crossing over a recombination and making a really good DNA. And the other is by each one covering for the other, or complementation. And both of these phenomena are important, and there are many problems in the problem book that allow you to distinguish these two and see what the features are, and they are summarized here in your handout on the top. Because you can see the testing, can I get function back by recombination, is a way of asking, are the mistakes in the same spot or overlapping or are they not? If I can get function back, the mutations didn't overlap. But complementation is a way of asking, if the mutations are in the same functional unit, the same gene, also in this context, known as a cistron. Cistron means gene in the sense of functional unit. So a complementation test doesn't allows you to tell whether your mutations were in the same functional unit or different functional units, which also allows you to assess the number of functional units. Now, in your notes at the end, there is some more terminology about this particular setup, which will help you with doing the problems. We're not going to go over it now. It's there for your reference purposes. Now, what we're going to do next time is we're going to go back and look at a few features of viral reproduction and viral sex that we did not consider, and also the fact that you can do complementation and recombination tests with viruses. So we'll stop here.